You're listening to an SBS News podcast.
When is World Prevention Shut it down!
Shut it down! Can I welcome you very much, Mr. President?
Spare a thought for Downing Street this afternoon.
I'm their Prime Minister, and this is their government.
They wouldn't talk to anybody else, but they're talking to me.
Jimmy Live has been sentenced to 20 years imprisonment.
Well, obviously, I keep fighting for his freedom. It's my dad.
Welcome to World News Weekly. I'm Katrina Stirrett, and joining me from Jakarta is our international correspondent, Claudia Farhat. Hello, Claudia.
Hello, Kat.
And in the Sydney studio today, I'm also joined by our international editor, Nick Ludlam. Welcome, Nick.
Hello.
Hello to you both on a week where Trump isn't dominating the spotlight. How can this be?
Kat, don't jinx it. We've still got to get through a half an hour recording.
Well, his name will certainly come up.
And we may not be focused on him entirely this week, but he's certainly in the news a fair amount.
Absolutely. And speaking of the news, Japan's first female Prime Minister, Sanae Takaichi, won a landslide election victory over the weekend. We'll discuss what it means for the region.
Plus, a slightly more unexpected election result in Thailand. We'll take a look at where the country's pro-democracy movement goes from here.
And what the sentencing of pro-democracy media mogul Jimmy Lai means for the West as it looks to beef up trade ties with China.
Yesterday, the people of our nation gave us a powerful push forward, urging us to carry through with a shift in policy no matter what. I offer my heartfelt gratitude. Strengthening and enriching the Japanese archipelago marks the beginning of a very heavy responsibility. I feel a renewed sense of resolve.
A huge rebranding for Japan's Liberal Democratic Party after years of declining support in a gamble that has paid off for Prime Minister Sanae Takaichi. Takaichi won the biggest majority in Parliament for any leader since World War II over the weekend after calling a snap election last month. Now, with a supermajority of 316 out of 465 seats, while she's one of the most socially conservative leaders Japan has seen in years, Takaichi is promising a more liberal spending approach to address cost of living woes and repair the world's fourth largest economy. It was only a few months ago, Claudia, that we were talking about how the LDP was tanking in the polls, and now Sanae Takaichi has led them to the single biggest election win in Japanese history. How did she turn it around?
There was one exit poll, Kat, that I think was from NHK that summed it up kind of perfectly. They said 75% of supporters leaving the polls said that they supported Sanae Takaichi as leader, but less than 40% of them supported her party, the LDP. Mm. So there's clearly still a lot of frustration directed at the party for all of the woes that the country has gone through over the past few years under its leadership. You know, there's been that slush fund scandal, huge allegations of corruption directed at the party that have run to very senior levels. The economy, as you mentioned, has been struggling and the cost of living is surging. The price of rice alone doubled just last year in Japan. It's affecting pretty much everyone from all walks of life. But somehow Sanae Takaichi has evaded blame for this, possibly because she's, you know, a relatively new leader, although she was very senior in the cabinet of previous governments, LDP governments as well. But it's obvious that she's just hugely popular. I mean, there are a few reasons for that. She found herself in this major spat with China, I guess sort of inadvertently, over some comments that she made in the Diet over Taiwan, comments that would have seemed at the time to her fairly innocuous, I suppose. But then when China tried to punish her for it, she wouldn't back down. So she was instantly seen by the public as this defender of the country. And then she really lent into it. She vowed to beef up the military. And that landed exceptionally well with the voter base as well. There's also been a huge amount of anger directed at foreigners, at immigrants in the Japanese public in recent years. She promised to crack down on immigration. She was really leaning into that as well. And she promised to cut taxes to bring the cost of living down. How she's actually going to fund that is another question, but it seems to have landed very well with voters. And I think, importantly, she is unusually loved by Donald Trump as well. And Japan realizes how important that relationship is now more than ever in this age of trade wars and tariffs. So when she called this election, she said she wanted a mandate from the public, not just from her party. She's now got one, and a huge one at that, but there are still a lot of challenges ahead for her.
Yeah, and Nick, Beijing has already made it clear it's not happy with the result. The foreign ministry spokesperson reacted by once again demanding she retract those comments over Taiwan. It seems pretty clear she's not going to do that. So is her win going to have security implications for the region?
Look, I'm not sure that there's anything immediately to be worried about in this regard. It's always a bit nerve-wracking when you have a major power like China who's sort of saber-rattling in this regard. But they do have a history of being incredibly sensitive to anything regarding Taiwan and anything that they perceive as moving the dial on Taiwanese independence. The comments that were made, I mean, in and of themselves, nobody would normally consider them particularly untoward.
She suggested that if there was a military blockade of Taiwan, then Japan may have to help or intervene. And that's what triggered this visceral reaction from China.
She's obviously a known hawk as well, which doesn't help. But China do like to get on the front foot in terms of pushing first. They like to see if they can get people to sort of back off. She hasn't, but we'll see where it ends up. I think it has worked in her favour for the election anyway. And while the relationship with China is hugely important for Japan, I think she is somebody that seems at least clear in her messaging that she won't be cowed by that sort of aggressive wolf warrior diplomacy, as it became known after Xi sort of took over. China is willing to use trade as a weapon. We've seen that. Rare earths is one of their trump cards. Japan has tried to sort of boost their rare earths production. They've got an island in the south that's been a bit contentious, but it's a long way from actually happening. I mean, nobody is independent of China's rare earth production. So everybody needs everybody still in this situation. We'll see where the power sort of play lands. But she's got a lot of wiggle room, given that such a big landslide means nobody in her own party, let alone the sort of disjointed opposition, can really challenge her for some time.
And what does it mean for Trump? Do you think this is really good news for him to see how she's secured such a majority since they have such an allyship?
Oh, yeah. I think Trump is going to be delighted with this. I mean, he came out and openly supported her through his weight behind her. So he'll also see this as part of his own making. And she is one of the few Trump whisperers, as it were. So yeah, I'm sure he'll be delighted. She wants to increase spending on military. She's quite a hawk in that regard as well. They do fit. Whether they fit in all ways, who knows? We'll have to see, I think.
And on the military spending and her promises to beef up the military, the significance of how much she's won here is really important. She now controls 2/3 of the parliament, and that's the exact proportion that you actually need in Japan to initiate a referendum. So there are all of these clauses in Japan's constitution that sort of put limits on its military. It's meant to have a pacifist military. It's not meant to maintain a military capable of waging war. And that's why those comments she made in the Diet were so, I guess, seen as so contentious, because the threshold for Japan to enter a conflict is that it has to be a threat to its existence. It has to be an existential threat.
A direct threat to itself, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So now that she controls 2/3 of the parliament, it is very possible, and we know that there are elements within the LDP that want to do this, it's entirely possible that she could now initiate a push to amend the constitution and perhaps soften some of those clauses to allow the military to become even stronger.
Our people have given us more than what we expected. We owe our voters a fortune.
Another landslide election win, this time for conservative politics in Thailand, as incumbent Prime Minister Anutin Chanvarukul's Bumjaithai Party won 193 out of the 500 House of Representative seats, paving the way for coalition partnerships to secure a majority. Chanvarukul became Prime Minister back in September, but on the condition he'd call elections within 6 months. Success was widely expected for the Progressive People's Party following their predecessor's popularity back in 2023, but it seems the public chose nationalist sentiment and stability over change. All this, of course, over the backdrop of increasing tensions between Thailand and Cambodia. Claudia, you were in Thailand for the election. What was the atmosphere like following news of the result? Did anyone over there see this coming?
Nobody at all, Kat, not even Anutin Charmpirakul himself. I mean, it was clear how surprised he was when he came out to speak to the press at about 10 o'clock on voting night. Every single poll in the country had the People's Party not just ahead to win this, but way ahead to win this, to win even bigger than they did last time around. But I guess, you know, hindsight's a beautiful thing. And if we look back on it now, it was sort of the perfect storm for Anutin. So as you alluded to, he called the election during the height of these border clashes with Cambodia. Like in Japan, nationalism played a really big part in this. Unlike in Japan, nobody in Thailand seems to think it was a happy accident. Everyone we spoke to in Bangkok seemed to be convinced that Anutin Charmpirakul had instructed the military to ramp up those clashes along the border back in December with the intention of dissolving the parliament, as he did only a couple of days after they reignited. And now that it's proven to be such a winning strategy, he's really not shying away from it. He came out on Monday morning, said he was going to build a wall, something else we've heard another billionaire turned president promised to do in another part of the world. So it's proven to be incredibly popular. People saw that coming. Everyone knew that nationalism was going to be a big part of the strategy for him. I think what people didn't understand was going to be such a big factor, and that perhaps even Anutin didn't expect to be such a huge factor, was the Thai people's desperation right now for some sort of political stability. I mean, yes, the country is a democracy in the sense that it has elections every 4 years and people get to vote. It doesn't really operate as a democracy in the sense that it's really only the military-aligned, you know, conservative political parties that actually are allowed to see their terms through as prime minister. So as you mentioned at the last election, the progressives won that vote. They weren't allowed to form government, blocked by the Senate, blocked by the military. It was the party that came second that was allowed to run. And because they didn't belong to the political elite either, they had two of their prime ministers dismissed until they'd cycled through their entire list. And that's how Bumjai Thai and Anutin Charmpirakul ended up in power. He didn't campaign on that, but that might have actually turned out to be the bigger factor. I mean, voter turnout was down from 75% last time to 65%. There's clearly a lot of fatigue about this. And I think some people, a lot of people in Thailand just may have thought, well, if we vote these guys in, then at least we'll have some stability for the next 4 years.
Claudia, we tended to think, or at least I thought, the PP had a broad support in Thailand. In fact, sort of the liberal parties, the reformist parties had broad support. Certainly Thaksin Shinawat, when he came onto the scene, had a huge popular support. And the PP were the biggest party in the previous election. But it was fascinating to see your reporting from outside the capital and the complete 180 in terms of political views.
No, it wasn't just you who thought that, Nick. I mean, talking to anyone in Bangkok in the lead up to this election, the number one word that they would use is change. You ask them, what do you want from this election? We want change. Now's the time. We want to see something different. You know, I went to the final rally of the People's Party on Friday night. It was like electrifying, the atmosphere in there. It was like a concert. These people are like celebrities. The leaders walk in and people drape flowers around their necks. There was no sense at all that this was coming. And then when the results were coming in on Sunday night, and from the very beginning, it was clear that yes, you know, every constituency in Bangkok went to the People's Party, but obviously something had gone deeply wrong. So we knew we kind of had to get out of the city if we wanted to understand how this is how this had happened. So the next morning, we sort of got up early and started driving north to some of these regional and rural districts surrounding Bangkok. And it's clear as soon as you get there that this story is really about a huge divide that's emerged in Thailand between the capital and the rest of the country. Yes, in the capital, they want change. They want a stronger democracy. But as soon as you get out into the countryside, people are talking about the exact opposite things. They want familiarity. They want a sense of a strong country, which is why the military lines landed so well there. And unlike in Australia, the major cities don't make up most of the population in Thailand. There is a huge rural population, so their vote really matters. One thing about Anutin's strategy that was very interesting, and this works really differently to how it does in Australia. Like in Australia, you would never see really, you know, a Liberal or National MP switch to the Labor Party. I mean, it's happened once or twice, but it's highly unusual. In Thailand, Newton's strategy and probably the reason he was so successful here was that he recruited local power brokers that had been members of other parties before to convert to his side. And so speaking to people outside the city, they didn't necessarily feel like they were voting for Bum Jai Thai or voting for Newton. They were voting for this person that's been in their community for decades, right, that they grew up with, that came to their kid's wedding, that went to their parents' funeral. It's incredibly personal politics, and the People's Party just couldn't play to that, you know, as a relatively newcomer onto the political scene.
So where does all that leave the pro-democracy movement? Will they really have to try and win the hearts and minds of those in the region, as you described?
Yeah, they're definitely going to have to try to. It's going to be tough, though, because it's a youth-led movement and a lot of the rural population is older and have really long-standing, decades-long relationships, you know, with these political figures. Even though they've switched parties and that, they still identify with the local members. I mean, look, the party still is going to end up with something like, you know, between a fifth and a quarter of the seats in parliament. It'll still be the second largest bloc, and they're promising to be a strong opposition voice, you know, be the eyes of the people inside the parliament. But the reality is they have lost all their momentum right now. I mean, at the last election where they won it by a clear margin and did so well, that was coming off years of military rule, right, and massive protests in the streets of Thailand. So there was a lot of public anger. This election came off the back of years of instability, and voting for the People's Party would have just guaranteed more instability because they were never going to be allowed to form a government. We all saw how it went last time. It would have gone the exact same way. I think they lost a bit of their identity too, because as you mentioned, part of the deal that made Anutin Charnvirakul prime minister was that he'd call this election within 6 months. It was actually the People's Party that made that deal with him by throwing their vote as the biggest bloc in parliament behind him. And I think a lot of their supporters saw that as a bit contradictory. How could you be supporting the establishment when you're meant to be anti-establishment? The really confusing thing, though, was the referendum result. Concurrent to the election for the parliament, the Thai people were asked to vote in a referendum on Sunday on whether they should have a new constitution. The current one was written by the military. It's basically just a way to shore up the military's rule long after the junta left office. And it looks like that's going to pass with a two-thirds yes vote. So the confusing thing is voters clearly do still want change. They've voted for change. But now with an establishment government, they're not likely to get it.
This 20 years is a farce. It's essentially tantamount to a life sentence, or as Human Rights Watch calls it, a death sentence. Because in the conditions that my father is being kept in, I don't know if he even has a tenth of that.
British citizen and pro-democracy media tycoon Jimmy Lai was sentenced to 20 years in prison on Monday after he was found guilty of national security offences last December, including foreign collusion and the publishing of seditious material. The vocal China critic is the most high-profile casualty of the harsh security laws imposed by Beijing after massive pro-democracy protests were crushed. The 78-year-old's son called it a death sentence, as we just heard. Western governments, including the UK and US, have called for his release for years. Joining us now is Dr. Feng Shongyi, an associate professor in China Studies at UTS. Thanks so much for joining us on the pod, Feng.
Thank you for having me.
The UK Prime Minister was in China 2 weeks ago talking up a new era of UK-China relations and didn't mention Lai publicly, at least. Is this a sign of economic desperation on the part of the UK or more quiet diplomacy, do you think?
I think it's quite simple. The UK government in particular, in recent years, just push aside the agenda of human rights and other even humanitarian concerns for short-term business benefit. That is not good behavior of a democratic government. And I'm quite disappointed that the international community, especially the liberal world, did not do anything meaningful to cause any cost of this regime. Even the British Prime Minister went to Beijing to appease this regime. I'm very disappointed with the political leadership in the democratic world.
Do you think this is going to really make sort of democratic Western countries take pause in their dealings with Beijing, given they're all courting Beijing for better economic deals? post sort of Trump Liberation Day tariffs, etc. Will this change anything, do you think?
I don't think so. My observation is that both the right and the left wing of political forces, political parties in the West, did not really understand the confrontation between Communist China and the West. We are actually in the what we call the Second Cold War as a confrontation or conflict between liberal democracy and totalitarian communist regime. They are very consciously fighting to undermine liberal democratic forces around the world, especially the internal democratic forces in China, including Hong Kong. They won't change this approach because that's the nature of the regime itself. And the West, as you mentioned, put their short-term commercial benefit in front of everything else. And this all worked into the advantage of this communist dictatorship.
Feng, when it comes to Jimmy Lai, the US President Donald Trump said he was going to get him released. He couldn't do it. Keir Starmer said he was going to raise the issue as well. He couldn't make any progress. I mean, we're talking about the leaders of two of the world's, what should be two of the world's most powerful countries. If they weren't able to achieve a result, does that mean there's really no country in the world that's able to influence the Chinese government right now?
Yes, you are right. The only country that feared by the CCP is the United States. But it's very unfortunate that President Donald Trump believes in deal. He somehow believes he can make any deal with anyone. The dictatorship like the CCP regime is a totalitarian regime. One, their survival is at stake. They won't make any deal. This regime by nature put the survival of the dictatorship in front of everything else. When Xi Jinping rose to the top, he has been determined to root out all these dissidents, including civil society itself. If you look at the political persecution since 2012, all these traditional democratic organizations, the human rights lawyers, the Tibetan Uyghur resistance, but they also extend their corruption across the borders to take out democratic and liberal forces in Hong Kong. That's exactly why they formulate this Hong Kong version of national security law and apply it even more ruthless than back in the mainland. Actually, Hong Kong is become a normal city of the mainland. And that's why we met with this brutal suppression of Li Zhiyin and many other heroes. All my friends, you name it, He Junren, Huang Zifeng, Zhou Xintong, all those heroes have now put in jail or forced into exile. It's very, very brutal suppression.
Thanks so much for joining us today, Feng. We really appreciate all your insights.
Thank you very much.
Okay, time for a quick look at some of the other big stories around the world this week. Israel's Security Cabinet has approved a raft of measures designed to make it easier for settlers to take over territory in the occupied West Bank. It's going to repeal laws that had effectively banned the direct sale of West Bank land to non-Palestinians and required anyone purchasing property there to have a transaction permit. It's also going to give Israeli agencies far more authority over the areas of the West Bank that are supposed to be under the control of the Palestinian Authority. Israeli monitoring groups and a really large section of the international community are condemning these changes as another step towards Israel's de facto annexation of the territory. And Netanyahu's far-right finance minister Bezalel Smotrich so much as admitted that when he announced the moves, saying, quote, "We are burying the idea of a Palestinian state."
A visit by Israeli President Isaac Herzog to Australia has resulted in a police crackdown on protests in Sydney this week. Herzog came to meet with and pay respect to victims of the Bondi terror attack in December last year. While victims and some members of the Jewish community welcomed the president's visit, others demonstrated in opposition across major Australian cities. The UN independent inquiry found that comments made by Herzog claiming all Palestinians were responsible for October 7 amounted to incitement of genocide, a claim Herzog refutes, insisting his comments were taken out of context. This as Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has defended the decision to invite the Israeli president to Australia, saying it afforded him an opportunity to raise the issue of Australian humanitarian worker Zomi Francom, who was killed in Israeli drone strikes, along with her six World Central Kitchen colleagues. Zomi's brother Mal Francom spoke to our chief political correspondent Anna Henderson. Here's a bit of what he had to say on the lack of progress in the investigation.
It's still very frustrating, but we still hold faith. We will be, you know, determined to pursue justice and accountability, not only for Zomi, but for the seven victims of the April 1 strike. And I've spoken to a few of their families as well, and they're in a similar position with kind of being in the dark and not having any updates.
Indonesia says it's preparing to send up to 8,000 soldiers to Gaza as part of Donald Trump's planned international stabilization force. The army's chief of staff says a site in southern Gaza has already been designated as barracks for his forces and that their training is underway. President Prabowo Subianto copped a lot of criticism locally last month when he agreed to join Donald Trump's Board of Peace. Indonesia is the world's largest Muslim nation and has long been a staunch supporter of the Palestinian cause. And there are still a lot of doubts here over how the board is going to make decisions for their future.
And protests against Donald Trump's immigration crackdown, yes, we have to have Trump in there somewhere, have followed the US Winter Olympics delegation all the way to Milan in Italy. Police fired tear gas and water cannons on crowds protesting against the US's decision to deploy ICE officers as part of their team's security detail. Vice President J.D. Vance was also there and met with loud boos when the camera cut to him and his wife Usha during the opening ceremony. We've since seen some US athletes use their press conferences during the games to speak out against ICE's campaign at home, earning the social media ire of the US president.
Oh, but that's not the only controversy to hit the Winter Olympics. The ski jump has been rocked by Penisgate. A phrase I never thought I'd say on the pod. It stems from accusations that some male ski jumpers in Milan are going to great lengths to gain an advantage by injecting hyaluronic acid into their penises to enlarge them.
Now, this may sound like an off-colour and incredibly painful joke. However, the World Anti-Doping Agency is taking it very seriously and says they'll investigate the claims. You may be asking yourself, why on earth would anyone want to do that? And it would be an excellent question. But it turns out one of the critical elements of ski jumping is the surface area of your suit. So anything that will increase the surface area of your suit obviously helps to keep you afloat longer and therefore you jump further. It's something that has dogged ski jumping competitions for a long time. Not this particular element, but the attempts to sort of inflate their ski jump suits. So it's really a matter of physics. And because they're so au fait with everybody trying every single trick they can up their sleeve to sort of enlarge their suits, officials have to microchip uniforms to ensure that they're not altered after they've been checked over.
You've really done a deep dive, scientific deep dive into this, and I really appreciate that.
I feel the Winter Olympics are an important event in the news calendar. Claudia, are you not a big fan of the Winter Olympics?
I'm just going to say nothing to add from me, guys. Thank you.
Oh. Wow, silence. And that is The World This Week. We have new episodes every Thursday. Be sure to like and subscribe wherever you get your pods.
As always, thank you to the wonderful producers behind World News Weekly. They are Nick Ludlam, Ali Cheevers and Billy Dallenberg. And see you guys next week.
See you next week.
See ya.